following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation is by Bill Hoesch and is entitled Explosive Evidence for Noah's Flood. For a free catalog of all of our tapes and books, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 or on the web at www.compass.org.
Well, good morning, everybody. The Lord bless you this morning. I am a research geologist with the Institute for Creation Research, and I am a Christian, and I believe that God is sovereign in earth history. When God rose from the dead for my sins, I believe God was sovereign over earth history. When he created in 6 days, I believe he was sovereign over earth history. When he sent a world flood, I believe he was sovereign over earth history. We have every good reason, as scientists and as Christians, to believe the truth claims of Scripture just exactly as they're written. And today I'd like to give you just a little, take you on an unusual departure. We're going to look at Mount St. Helens, and I want to take you through the explosion of that mountain, and I want you to appreciate some of the lessons that geologists have been able to gain from that experience, lessons about geology and lessons about life itself. And I think it's a good challenge to help you to think about this issue of Earth history, because everywhere we go today, we're being confronted with stories that the Earth is surely proven to be, hundreds of millions of years, and that slow and gradual is the way everything has developed in Earth history. Well, I'm here to tell you that I am an unrepentant catastrophist. Okay, I believe that catastrophes have played a much larger role in shaping this Earth's crust than any kind of slow and gradual process. And so this happens to be, if you do visit our book table, which I hope you do, this happens to be on videotape. Dr. Steve Austin gives this presentation, very similar to what I'm giving. So you can get that. And please do visit our book table. We have a lot of resources available. Our website is www.icr.org. We have a free sign-up sheet. You can get mailings. So you can stay abreast of some of the exciting things going on in research, like some of the Grand Canyon discoveries we've been in on, and as well as some of the radiometric dating research. Anyway, let's go ahead and have a look at explosive evidence for Noah's flood. Mount St. Helens, prior to the 1980 eruption, was a very beautiful place. It was about 9,700 feet tall, Spirit Lake to the north of it. Beautiful, luxuriant forest, really a rainforest condition out there. Artists and other nature lovers would come from all over the world to visit this mountain. Get this image in your mind, a very beautiful, peaceful, serene image, because all of it is about to change. By the way, the forest that you're looking at there, you're looking at logs of Douglas fir that are 6-8 foot diameter trees. They're big trees. This is a rainforested area in the Pacific Northwest. What kind of volcano is this? We're gonna go on. You have to bear with me. I'm a geologist, and you have to go with a little bit of understanding here. Okay, we think that this is the way the volcano might look if it were in a cutaway view. This is called a composite cone volcano. The thing I want you to notice here, it's built up of layers of alternating ash and lava flows that have built up over the course of secular experts agree only a few thousand years, not millions of years or anything like that. So anyway, this type of volcano we know can erupt very explosively as opposed to other volcanoes in the world. This is prior to the 1980 eruption. You can see some of the older lava flows, probably from the earlier eruption, 123 years earlier. Back in the mid-1800s was the last time the volcano erupted prior to 1980. So this is an ancient frozen lava flow on the side of the mountain. Let's go over a little geography, if we could, because there's going to be some changes that take place, because I'm going to be referring to some of these areas. Mount St. Helens is the volcano right at the bottom of your screen there, 9,677 feet. This map is colored green to indicate this is all heavily forested area. Some other places that I'd like you to notice is Bear Meadow, 11 miles to the northeast. We can have a pointer there. Maybe we can 11 miles to the northeast is Bear Meadow. Spirit Lake, directly to the north of the volcano. Mount St. Helens being an enormously large mountain, it's right on the shores of Spirit Lake, really, the mountain is. And the Toodle River and the highway coming in from the left. All of this changes. After the eruption, you had destruction of 150 square miles of forest was toppled in 6 minutes as a result of the initial steam blast. And so this image is made to help you to see that everything turned gray pretty quickly. And Spirit Lake occupies a different area in space. The Toodle River drainage was reestablished. And so you see some radical changes that took place in the landscape. If you ever get a chance to visit there, do it. You will be, I guarantee, you will be unprepared for the scale of that volcano and the largeness of it. I went there in 1984, 4 years after the major eruption, and I remember driving through that rainforest and, you know, seeing the deer and the squirrels, and you come up over a ridge, and suddenly everything's gray, and it just took your breath away. It was literally, I almost had to pull over. Well, what were the events that led up to the eruption there? March 27th, 1980, the volcano awakens after 123 years. Steam begins issuing from the crater on the summit, as well as cracks in the snowfield and seismic activity. There was an earthquake that marked the awakening of the volcano. This is some of the initial steam blasts. You're looking northward. There's Spirit Lake to the north. It's covered with snow and ice. This is in the Pacific Northwest, where they do get an enormous snowpack every year. And notice the area around it is, of course, clothed with heavy forest. Right? Some of those initial early eruptions over the course of the first few weeks included some eruptions of ash. This is volcanic ash, which represents lava that hits the air and immediately crystallizes into fine particles. We call that material ash. And so there it is, just beginning to awaken. A lot of people thought this was jolly and fun. Gee, the volcano is erupting after so many years, and then people were selling little vials of ash on the roadside and so on at this stage. Little did they know the volcano was about to go into full-scale eruption. They noticed also on the summit, geologists began observing this behavior of the volcano, and they noticed that twin craters developed near the summit because of some of these steam and ash emissions. And over time, the twin craters joined to become a single crater, and you can see in the lower part of the picture an airplane for scale. This is right on the tip-top of the mountain. It's almost like the throat of the volcano is opening, and she's getting ready to blow. Scientists were alarmed at this time because they had discovered that the north slope of the volcano had been swelling at a rate of 3 to 5 feet per day. And there was a bulge that was about 450 feet out of normal on the north side of the slope. Everybody knew something big was about to happen, and people were warned to get out of the area at this point. The morning of May 18th. Morning of May 18th was an unusual morning because it was a Sunday morning, very peaceful. The people who lived in that area, they said it was almost an eerie type of calm that morning. And they looked around and they decided, let's go out and spend the day and do some nice things. So there's some people flying overhead, including two geologists in an airplane. And they're flying over the volcano at 8:30 that morning. And they look down on the volcano. This is, we're getting into the main eruption now, okay? They look down on the volcano, and they're flying right over the summit. They just thought they'd take a nice flight that morning. And they see this rockfall inside the crater right on the summit. Those are moving rocks that are falling in view there. And a few moments later, they make this observation. These two geologists, they said, we saw the most amazing thing. The entire north slope of the volcano began rippling and churning. That was their language. It was as if the whole mountain was like a bowl of jello. And then that whole north slope, now you're looking obliquely in this picture toward the west. This is the north slope of the volcano. And if you look carefully, in the upper left, you can see a little cloud of steam. And in the lower right, you can see lots of ash billowing out in clouds. That represents one enormous slab of rock that's sliding. That's the largest landslide ever captured on film that you're looking at. So you're experiencing a real geologic wonder here, okay? And this is pretty spectacular. And these people who are flying overhead in the airplane, they took this photo from the air. Amazing to think about. After this, then the volcano went into full-scale eruption. That landslide that from that oversteepened north side of the volcano, when it slid away, you see, it released the pressure on that superheated water at depth, which is water mixed with the magma, and it flashed to steam immediately, and it was like shaking up a pop bottle and popping the cork, you see. And it was a northward-directed steam blast. Notice you can see the fin of the airplane in the upper right, the stabilizer there. And these guys, I'm sure they're glad they made it across the mountain just at that moment. If they would have been passing by only a minute earlier, they probably would have been part of the debris that's being hurled northward at this time. Anyway, pretty cool to look at. Here's a shot of the initial eruption 11 miles to the northeast at Bare Metal. A photographer out there was out that morning, 8:30 that morning. I think he may have been out camping. His name's Keith Ronholm. Had his camera tripod set up and so on, and just thought he'd, I suspect he was enjoying a nice cup of coffee that morning. And suddenly he feels this earthquake. He sees this landslide, probably, and the volcano goes into full-scale eruption right in front of him. And he has got a first-class seat from 11 miles away. He gets to capture this kind of a photograph. A few moments later, this is the image that he captured. Here you have certainly house-sized boulders, as well as large chunks of glacial ice that are being hurled outward at tremendous speed. Now, this is actually a northward-directed blast. Most geologists were not quite prepared for the severity of this, and it was it quickly turned into a ground-hugging slurry of hot volcanic ash and steam that went roaring over the landscape, right? And it's roaring northward at about a speed of about 200 miles an hour, okay? And inside that cloud, the temperature is well over 350 degrees centigrade, and so it's certainly able to toast anything in its path, right? A few moments later, Keith Ronholm takes this picture. This is all within minutes now. The steam and ash cloud is approaching his position. It's knocking over the forest as it advances. He is on this ridge adjacent to a place called Bare Metal. He takes this picture, and about this point, he makes a very wise decision. Right? Yeah. He gets in his late model Pontiac, hits that gas pedal as fast as he can, and goes down, gets down off that mountain, and he escapes northward. But he took one last picture over his shoulder as he did, and this is what he saw. All right? Imagine that. This is not soap suds, folks. This is superheated ash and steam, all right? And it's absolutely toppling the forest. Imagine seeing that coming after you, all right? But he actually did escape down off the ridge and escaped northward and drove away. And little did he know, I'm sure he thought he was toast, okay? But little did he know that ridge that he was standing on was just sufficient to deflect the waning energy of that blast cloud northward up over him. Right? Well, he drove away underneath it. So this is a northward, the steam and ash cloud is deflected up into the atmosphere just in time. If he was just a little bit to the right, the ridge where he was on was just to the right of your image there, you see. If he was there, he surely would have been toast, but he got down off that ridge and escaped, no doubt with an amazing story to share with his grandchildren and, photographs to go with it. Right? Imagine that. I'm sure that he thought he was dead. After that stage, the volcano goes into full-scale vertical eruption for a period of 9 hours. The energy output for that nine-hour interval was about one atomic bomb per second for 9 hours, one Hiroshima-sized atomic bomb for nine hours, and amazing the power of the volcano. The people who lived in that region were completely unprepared for this, and everybody said the same thing who lived up there. And they said, "We're sure that the world is coming to an end." that's the way it was. Pretty remarkable, that kind of an eruption. This is a more distant shot. You have volcanic ash going straight up into the upper atmosphere, well up above 40,000 feet, probably 50, 60,000 feet, into the jet stream. And that volcanic ash, of course, gets distributed over a large area. You're looking at a satellite image of the Pacific Northwest. You can see Washington State in the upper left and that donut-shaped cloud around the volcano, defining the blast zone. You say this was taken 43 minutes after the initial blast. Later on that same afternoon, the same satellite image looked like this, and you can see ash being streamed over a six-state area, including Washington State, Panhandle of Idaho, Montana. I was a well site geologist working in western Wyoming at the time, which is just inside the view there on the far right. And we had a little bit of ash there, and not too much. It was enough to give us nice red sunsets. It was kind of cool. Anyway, so this is, it certainly had a regional effect, blanketing the region with not snow, but volcanic ash. This is what it looked like in the streets of Yakima, Washington at 12 noon that day. The street lights turned on at 12 noon. And this is a little bit of the before and after picture. About 1,300 feet of the original mountain was removed, part of it during that landslide that slid northward, and part of it from evacuation of the magma chamber at depth. The magma is the liquid rock, the super molten material. And when that thing evacuated, the mountain sort of collapsed on itself, forming this crater, you see. And so 1,300 feet of the summit was removed. And remember that nice pristine shot we had at the beginning of the beautiful beautiful green forest and the lovely animals and so forth? All of it gone, gray. When I went there in 1984 and I saw that site, and it was beginning to be revegetated just a little bit by then, it's still the thing that went through my mind, I wonder what Sodom and Gomorrah looked like when the Lord was done with it. It made you tremble to think of the power of this kind of volcano. To the left side, you can see in the shadow Spirit Lake Basin. We can relive the events here. Again, the landslide slid towards you, toward the north. Now, a part of the landslide slid into Spirit Lake to the left. Another part of it slid to the right into the North Fork of the Toutle River drainage, and it formed a big landslide debris field there. Excuse me. You know what happens, don't you, when you have a large rock mass that slides into a body of water? It displaces that water, doesn't it? And it generates what's called a tsunami or a tidal wave. In this case, how big do you think the wave was on Spirit Lake? 860 feet up the far side of that mountain, a water wave washed up the far side of that mountain. How do you like that, surfers? You guys like to surf, anyone? No? 860 feet. Wow. And it's perfectly evident that it really did happen, because you can see the scour mark right at the edge of the forest where trees were absolutely beveled at root level, just cut like soft butter and sent hurtling down into Spirit Lake. And the lake was then covered with about 1 million logs, these gigantic logs, from a series of one or maybe several waves that washed up the side there. Nobody captured it on film, even though there were people flying overhead in an aircraft. I think the reason is pretty plain. They weren't looking at the lake. They were looking at the volcano, which was in full-scale eruption, right? They weren't planning their next fishing trip on the lake, you see. and so nobody captured that on film. That would have been quite spectacular to see. But it clearly did happen from the scour marks on the side of the mountain. And so this is the after kind of image. The ground surface, getting into the aftermath of the volcano now, the ground surface around the volcano was well over 200 or 300 degrees centigrade for several days, really hampering efforts to go in and determine if what kind of losses in terms of life took place. There were 57 people who lost their lives. Every one of them had a warning to get out of the area, but not everybody heeded that warning. Probably the most famous of these was an old fellow by the name of Harry Truman, who lived in the worst possible place. His lodge was right at the foot of the mountain on the shore of Spirit Lake, and he was the fellow that was warned several times to leave, and he refused to leave, and he just decided to go down with his ship, so to speak, and he got buried. Most people, when we're lucky, we get about 6 feet of burial on top of us. He got about 600 feet, all right, of landslide debris as well as volcanic ash. Logging trucks, this is a logging area, were hurled like toys, in many cases hundreds of feet. Unbelievable power. No loss of life there. The people had all abandoned their operation zone. This is the what remained of the forest in the blast zone. And these are not toothpicks, folks. These are great big logs, 6-8 foot diameter Douglas fir and yellow spruce and several other species. And enough lumber there, enough lumber to build, they estimated, 640,000 three-bedroom homes, right? So that's a lot of wood, right? And the timber companies, what do you think they thought when they saw this? Hallelujah, boys, we got a harvest, you know? So they fired up their chainsaws, and they got disappointed very quickly because their chainsaws got dull rapidly because of the abrasive nature of the ash that was all around the logs and in them and so on. And so it's a fascinating thing to think about. It could possibly be the case today that those logs are already beginning to petrify because we know that the process by which when you have volcanic ash, it gets a little bit wet. It gives up its silica very easily. Silica is the stuff that petrifies wood. No problem at all to have petrified wood in a short time frame. Everybody knows this in geology. Petrified wood, as well as any fossil that we know of, does not take millions of years to form. Geologists know better than this. What it takes is you get the right chemistry. If the chemistry is right, the process can happen quickly. You can petrify logs in a short period of time. If the chemistry is only half there, then it'll take longer time, you see. And so it's got nothing to do with time when you talk about it. So even though in our culture we say he or she is old as a fossil, you know, that's a silly statement because it's not true, right? It's dependent on chemistry. Time is not a factor in it. And by the way, if you let me borrow your bathtub, I can stir in it some naturally occurring chemicals, throw some wood in there, and petrify it for you in a matter of days. It doesn't take long ages in that type of experiment either. Okay. Continuing on in the aftermath of the destruction. Now, the largest in terms of dollar loss was very dangerous mud flows. You know what happens, don't you, when you mix, when you have a snow-covered mountain, and you have lots and lots of snow and ice, and you mix that with hot volcanic ash, it produces what? It produces this stuff that geologists give a technical term, we call mud, right? And mud is incredibly powerful when it starts moving at high velocity, right? And imagine a cement-like slurry sweeping down some of these river channels, and it had a way of incorporating material from the bed of the river into it, and as well as the water diluting it. And these things were able to perpetuate themselves and go many, many miles downstream from the volcano. And as they do, they carry with them logs, they carry with them boulders, houses, motorhomes, whatever happens to get in its path, along it goes. And most of the flooding that you read about in places like Europe and China, which is going on as we speak, it frequently is mud flows. It's a very lots and lots of suspended mud in the material, which makes it very, very powerful. Anyway, big dollar loss. This was the remains of a logging camp here, the remains of a logging camp that was along the Toodle River. And you can see the trucks in there for scale, and it reminds you that those logs are quite big. And this is these were all carried by the mud, and the mud became more liquefied and eventually moved downstream from here. We're looking now in the actual throat of the volcano. This is called the lava dome. The lava dome being the solidified mass in the actual throat of the volcano. And there were several of these that formed. After the first eruption, a lava dome formed, and then it was blasted out on June 12th, about a month later, and another big eruption followed. And then it happened several other times, and there were about six of them that formed and were blasted out and then formed again. It was in this area, after the lava dome solidified, in around the time of 1990 or so, that ICR scientists decided to sample some of the rocks here for the purpose of dating, right? Called radiometric dating. And we decided to apply this one method called the potassium-argon dating method, which is considered to be, or used to be at least, considered to be very authoritative in geologic circles for determining the age at which time a liquid rock solidifies to a hard rock, you see. And that's what the potassium-argon dating method is supposed to tell you, right? We got numbers that were, on the order of 3.5 million years old for a volcano that we know is no older than 10 years at the time we collected the samples. What am I saying? Something is desperately wrong with those dating methods. You do get extremely inconsistent results. And a lot of research underway at the institute where I'm at on radiometric dating, because this is considered to be very, very authoritative. And we'd like to give positive answers for our faith and say, what do those isotopes really mean, rather than just say that it gives contradictory dates. Well, what do you think the scientific community said about this? They'd say, obviously this type of volcano had excess argon when it was erupted, therefore it gave you a faulty date, a date that was excessively old. Obviously that's what must have happened. And you see, they give these kind of answers, and the public just doesn't even know that there's big problems. For example, how do they know when they date an ancient rock where they don't have a volcano associated with it, how do they know that that also didn't have excess argon with it? You see, there's no way to check those assumptions. These are methods that are fraught with assumptions. And one of my job titles at ICR is I'm one of the date busters, okay? And we like collecting rocks and seeing what we get for dates, and we can show some amazingly inconsistent results. This is a view looking down on the lava dome. You can see this was taken a few years after the main eruption. You can still see some of the hot rock seething there in the cracks of the lava dome.
Well, what are some of the lessons that we can learn from a volcano like this? It's nice to talk to you about volcanoes and geology. This is what I love to do. But what can we learn and take with us, right? Let's look at what the deposits consisted of, all right? And I'm going to try not to bore you too much with the details of stratigraphy and so on. But you're looking at the shores of Spirit Lake here. Spirit Lake is to the right. The Mount St. Helens is just to the left. And you're looking toward the west, and you can see that lumpy, hummocky terrain that represents the landslide debris that came to rest in that area. The deposits in that area are about 600 feet deep of brand new deposits that came to rest. And what was the nature of those deposits? Can we get a view of those a little better? Well, the fortunate thing is there were mud flows that carved through that debris down, about 100 feet into it. And so we can get a cross-sectional view of the of these layers, which is kind of fun for me. Look at that, all right? Pretty cool. This is the kind of stuff geologists like. You can see a layer in the middle part of the section there. It's about 25 feet thick. That probably was formed in a matter of a few hours, all right? The entire package of sediment we're looking at here, we're looking at three successive eruptive deposits that happened afterwards. But anyway, the thing that gets my eye as a geologist is look at the layering in that middle unit. I always thought that if you get a homogeneous slurry, this was probably formed by the initial blast cloud with ash and turbulent material and steam all mixed up together. I would think you'd get a very homogeneous type deposit, a very mixed up. I wouldn't expect to see layering like that. But when we look closer at it, we can see layering even at a finer scale. At a finer scale yet. Fascinating. This was formed, you're looking at rocks here that probably formed in a matter of minutes or seconds that we're looking at, and yet somehow this steam and ash cloud must have been a pulsating kind of nature to separate the coarse and fine debris to get these discrete layers. And even at a super fine scale, we can see properties in the rock that are very, very amazing to look at, because I was always trained as a geologist. By the way, my bachelor's degree was from CU in Boulder here, down the road. I got my bachelor's in geology there. I was always taught that layering like that is always the product of slow and gradual deposition, not, you know, typically something over the course of, you know, thousands, if not millions of years, you see. And yet we know this happened in a matter of seconds, literally. Challenges me when I go elsewhere. This is a picture now of Grand Canyon. You're looking in Grand Canyon now at layered deposits there that were clearly deposited by water. Makes me wonder how those things formed. Did you know that geologists are being challenged now to wonder and to look afresh at the sedimentary layers in Grand Canyon? And there's some remarkable conclusions that are being drawn.
More and more people are being convinced that these layers did not form slowly and gradually, but they were formed catastrophically by something like an underwater landslide or something like an underwater avalanche of sand and debris that moved over the sea bottom much the same way as the steam and ash cloud blasted over Mount St. Helens area. Well, that's a little bit about rapid formation of strata. Let's see if we can learn some things about erosion, erosional features. Fascinating things to learn here. A lot of that hot volcanic ash and landslide debris came to rest on glacial ice. And material that's about 300 degrees centigrade resting on ice, something usually happens there. The ice underneath, of course, melts, and in many cases it flashed to steam. And the steam actually reamed holes. It just jetted holes up through the freshly deposited ash layers, and it formed what's called steam explosion pits, which are kind of fun to look at. All right, here's one. This pit, from the top of the rim down to the flat bottom of that pit, is about 100 feet. And this is the remains after the steam finished jetting to the surface. This is what it looked like. Now, I always thought as a geologist that to get that kind of funny type of erosional pattern, that scalloped edge, kind of looks like the Badlands in South Dakota, I always thought that's the product of a mature landscape that developed over hundreds of thousands of years. And yet, you know what? This happened instantly as a result of gravity collapse. It had nothing to do with the agency of water eroding over millions of years. It happened very quickly. So it challenges the way I think about how landscapes form. Other features include canyons cut through solid rock. This is an andesitic rock. Some of the rock prior to the 1980 eruption that was carved by mud flows to the tune of about 100 feet in this canyon. This is another canyon cut, again, very deeply by raging mud flows coming down off the summit area. Tells me that you can form a canyon in one day through solid rock. This is the kind of rock you can hit with a hammer and it rings. This is not soft rock here. In one day, canyons formed like this as a result of moving mud at high speed. You can do an awful lot of geologic work in a short period of time, it reminds me. And so I have to think about this when I consider my geology. This is a view of one of the mud flows, just to give you a picture of what it looked like, one of the later mud flows that built up in the crater and then came spilling out. And it actually, this is the one that actually carved a whole network of canyons in the area downstream. Here you're looking at an aerial view of an area that today is called the Grand Canyon of the North Tootle. All right, this is a closer look now. And if we get a little closer still, look at those steep walls, kind of flat tops on the mesas, steep walls, canyon like that. That canyon formed in one day. All right, whoops, I got to go back. That canyon formed in one day, folks, by a mud flow that came ripping through there. All right, and look at the little stream running through the middle of it. You know, you might go there, or as a geologist, you might think, must have taken that little stream long ages to carve that great big canyon. You'd be wrong, wouldn't you? Because that stream had nothing to do with the formation of that canyon. It was carved by a mud flow, and the stream just happens to be passing through, right? So the stream, it's just a leftover of what was there. You better believe this challenges me in the way that I think about how canyons form in general. This is another view of that. Look at the little stream up against the great big walls there in that canyon. It challenges me about the canyon of canyons, right? This is a satellite image of Grand Canyon. Now, I just happened to fly over Grand Canyon yesterday, and it was really nice. I came from San Diego to Colorado Springs, and the shadows were just getting long. Oh, I better keep going. Yeah. This is a satellite image. It's not nearly as pretty, but nevertheless, you can get the overall spread of this enormous canyon. The Colorado River, of course, drains from the upper right and drains southward, and then it cuts abruptly toward the west, and it cuts across that rusty red-colored landscape, and then it cuts and eventually drains into the Gulf of California southward, right? Spent a lot of time inside that canyon. Anyway, it's peculiar to geologists that this is a river that goes across a mountain. This is the rust red color. It's false color imagery is what it is. It really indicates that that's elevated terrain. That's up at 7,000 or 8,000 feet elevation, 9,000 feet elevation, and so the river actually cuts across. How did that canyon form anyway? Did that little river over millions of years carve the great big canyon? You know, there's three theories for the formation of the Grand Canyon. Have you heard this? Three theories. One is that it was a little bit of water and a lot of time. That little Colorado River over millions of years slowly and gradually plucked sand, you know, one grain at a time out of the walls of that canyon. That's one theory. Second theory is a lot of water and a little bit of time. Okay? Maybe something like Mount St. Helens where there must have been some kind of big flood that came through there. By the way, the Havasu Indians believe that. They believe the Havasu Indians who live in the canyon, they believe there was once one time the gods became angry with them, and they sent judgment in the form of a global flood. But God was gracious, and He provided a big dugout canoe for man and the animals to survive it. Where'd you heard that story before? You know? Anyway, and they think that when the waters left the earth, it carved the Grand Canyon. And then the third theory for the formation of Grand Canyon is that it all got started when a Scotchman lost a nickel down a gopher hole. Okay. I kind of like the second theory myself. Okay. You see, he was thrifty and he wanted to fun. Okay, never mind. Okay. So Grand Canyon, here's what I think happened. In the upper right of this picture here, it's very easy to imagine large impounded lakes, maybe even salt water, following the flood. You see, I believe the flood happened in Earth history in the not too distant past. You had large impounded lakes in the upper right here on the scale of the Great Lakes, and I think there's really good evidence for this in the form of lake deposits that are found in northern Arizona. If those lakes began to fill up and fill up and fill up, perhaps in a post-flood ice age, not an age of millions of years, but a shorter ice age, during a wet climate, it's possible that those lakes began to spill over the top of the dam, which is this uplifted area here in the center of the view, and the waters drained, they began to downcut, and catastrophically there was a breach dam model for the formation of Grand Canyon. Believe it or not, as radical as that is being embraced by secular geologists today more and more. It's still a minority view, but there's more and more viewpoint on that for a rapid formation of Grand Canyon. So the Colorado River, if you ever go there today, you might be able to think about that. Maybe that river is just passing through, and it had nothing to do with the formation of that canyon, right? Because I think that really is the best scientific answer for the formation of Grand Canyon. So there's lots of things we can learn from Mount St. Helens that, again, it gets us thinking about these things. I like what Frank Peretti had to say. We serve a God of truth, don't we? He's building a kingdom of truth, right? And those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. And so when I go out and I look at the things in the field as a geologist, I see agreement, amazing agreement, between a catastrophic view of Earth history and Scripture. Okay, let's move on. This is Charles Darwin, right? And most people don't know that good old Charles, when he was on his voyage of the Beagle, he first became convinced of geological gradualism, that the Earth is shaped slowly and gradually over millions of years. He became convinced of that on philosophical grounds, not because of science. And then after that, he observed the Santa Cruz River in Argentina, and he made this conclusion. The river, though it has so little power in transporting even inconsiderable fragments, yet in the lapse of ages, might produce by its gradual erosion an effect of which it is difficult to judge the amount. Okay, so he's saying that even though this is an enormous canyon in South America that he was looking at, he says it must have taken millions of years to do it. Right? So he was first convinced of geological gradualism. Then he went where? He went to the Galapagos Islands, and he started studying the animals and stuff there. And he started thinking, maybe there was biological gradualism, too. Maybe animals change ever so slowly over millions of years, you see. And evolution was born out of this view. But it was geology that turned his ear first. It's very important to know that. So you biologists who think you're very important, no, it's geology is where it's at. Okay. This is Charles Darwin here. All right. Okay, let's move on. Just a few more lessons, and then I don't want to keep you too long. Logs and log deposits of Spirit Lake. Some really cool things to learn here. My colleague, Dr. Steve Austin, who's the main research geologist at ICR, one day he was eating his lunch on the shores of Spirit Lake in 1984. I happened to be with him then. And he was looking at these logs, these little sticks floating in the lake, eating his lunch. He started thinking, you know, there's about 1 million logs floating in that lake. I wonder if some of those things begin to float upright as well. And maybe they get waterlogged. They might even go kerplunk in a vertical position on the bottom of the lake. Kind of a wild idea. He started looking around the lake. Sure enough, started seeing some logs that had become vertical, in a vertical position. Look at that. Did some more looking, more vertical upright floaters. There's a whole school of them there. Right. Decided to do some research to confirm this. This is Dr. John Morris, who is going to deliver this talk today and couldn't make it, and another scientist in this research vessel. And they went out onto the lake using what's called a side scan sonar to get a view of the bottom of the lake, and they found literally millions or probably hundreds of thousands of logs vertically upright on the bottom of Spirit Lake. It would have looked like a forest if you would have drained the lake. But it wasn't forest trees that grew in place. Here's Dr. Steve and his diving buddy. They decided to go down and have a look at these logs. There they are, the two divers on the left of an upright floating log. Down they go into the murky waters. Upright floating log seen from beneath. And sure enough, logs settled in the bottom of the lake in a vertical position. It's not a very good picture. It's pretty murky water. But nevertheless, the root ends of these logs terminate very abruptly in that mud. Look at that. Right? And so what's the point of this? Who cares anyway about a bunch of logs in Spirit Lake? Well, there's Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone National Park is a place where they used to say there were dozens of fossil forests that grew in place, and obviously it must have taken hundreds of thousands of years for these forests, one forest to grow, then be buried under volcanic debris, and another forest to grow, be buried. This is, at Yellowstone National Park, and they used to make the claim that this represented long ages of time. Well, scientists have done some further looking at those, this is a picture of Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone now. And here's some of these upright fossil logs. They did some more looking at those logs, and they found out that the root ends terminate very abruptly. They also found no discrete soil layers between the logs, and they also found the tree limbs and the bark was missing off the logs as if they'd been transported. Scientists have reinterpreted those logs at Specimen Ridge, at least some have, and they've gone with a Mount St. Helens type of interpretation. So what was once thought to take long ages no longer is the case. And then finally, one more thing. The origin of coal is something that has flummoxed geologists because coal, of course, your big coal beds in the Midwest, coal represents what? It represents largely mummified tree bark. That's what it is. And it matches biochemically to that, and it has a layered appearance to it. How do most geologists believe coal formed? In a swamp millions of years ago, that's what they say. The logs eventually fall over and die, and they become pickled in the low oxygen waters of the swamp. And with time, it's converted into peat. Well, this is a drained peat swamp here. And what do you get in peat bogs? You get not layered material, no great preponderance of tree bark, something that does not match coal very well at all. There was a scientist at Penn State University who decided to write his PhD dissertation on a floating log mat model for the origin of coal. That's Dr. Steve Austin, the geologist that I work with. 1979, he defended his PhD dissertation on this model that there was once a flood that covered the Midwest, there was a log mat that was drifting about, and as the logs rubbed up against each other, the tree bark fell to the bottom. With time, it was buried, converted to coal, and this is how you got your coal beds, a flood model for the origin of coal. His advisors told him, Steve, we think you're crazy, but here's your degree anyway. You defended it very well. Thank you very much. Less than a year later, Mount St. Helens erupts. What do you think Steve wants to do? You guessed it. He wanted to go diving underneath that log mat and see what's down there. Sure enough, layers and layers of large sheets of coal, sheets of tree bark on the bottom of Spirit Lake, indicating what? This vindicates at least part of his model. You young scientists who are interested in doing science for God's glory, you keep doing your work and you keep persisting. Even if it's a radical idea, you hang in there, because sometimes the Lord provides a wonderful laboratory, this case in the form of Mount St. Helens. So a couple other things. Life has been flourishing in the blast zone since the eruption. Lots of plants have regrown, things that nobody would have expected. For example, the gophers and the ground squirrels, when the blast cloud came, they could not run it, so they burrowed down, okay? With time, they began churning the volcanic ash, mixing it with seeds. They become very effective farmers, you see. And it facilitated a rapid regrowth. Nobody could have predicted that. The deer and elk flourished in the blast zone, and they changed their behavior suddenly. The deer were having more twins and triplets than ever before. The elk loved it in the open blast zone area. They even changed their behavior to adapt to the new environment. Makes me wonder how life changed after there was a global flood on this earth. Makes me wonder, how did animals and peoples respond to a catastrophe like that? Let's try to wrap it up. Mount St. Helens, I think, is an event that's going to go down in history as something that challenges us regarding the sovereignty of God in earth history. Man wants to believe he's in control of things. Man wants to have his own creation story, even, that does not even doesn't even approach the Bible, right? And yet, it says in Scripture, it says, God touches the mountains and they smoke. God remains sovereign over earth history. He was in this case. I think he was in the past as well. Remarkable to think about this. So we learn from a volcano like this, not just about geology, because it certainly challenges the way we think about how canyons form, how layered rock forms, how coal forms, even upright logs, petrified logs. How do these things all form? Do they really demand long ages? No, I think they indicate and they point to massive catastrophes in the past. All right? It reminds me of one other thing as well. It reminds me of that passage in Scripture that says, you know, God is not willing that any should perish, but all come to repentance. You see, Harry Truman had a warning, didn't he? He had a warning to flee from the wrath to come, and he didn't. He did not heed that warning. He decided to go his own way, and I suspect he probably said things like, you know, Sonny, I've been here for years and years, and I've seen the sunrise and the sunset. I've seen the seasons come and the seasons go, and, you know, tomorrow will be just like today, only better, you know. And he swallowed that's what the mockers in the last days would swallow, that Peter warned about in 2 Peter chapter 3, that in the last days people would reject God's sovereignty in earth history. You read that passage. It's very fascinating. But Harry Truman did not heed that warning, and he paid the price. And it reminds me of God's grace, that he has made a way for us to escape the wrath, to flee to Christ in spirit and truth, to worship him and to find life in him. And this is good news. It changed my life about 20 years ago. I hope it changes yours as well. And so the volcano will go down, I think, in history as an event that I think rocked the science of geology and rocks man today concerning his ultimate sovereignty. All right, and is he really sovereign or not? Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Compass International is proud to present its first ever video for children. Filmed with the beautiful Northwest as a backdrop, a cast of over 50 children dramatize Hannah Hernard's classic Christian tale, Hinds Feet on High Places. A young crippled girl named Much Afraid is tormented by pride, bitterness, self-pity, and all of her other fearing relatives, until the kind shepherd leads her on a journey to the high places of the mountains in the kingdom of love, where perfect love casts out all fear. Join Much Afraid as she learns to lay down her will and accept the will of the shepherd in this compelling and imaginative allegory depicting the lessons of triumphing over evil, becoming acquainted with sorrow and suffering, and ultimately finding these things transformed into something incomparably precious. There are no obstacles which our Savior's love cannot overcome.
To receive a free catalog of all of our Bible teaching books and tapes, information on upcoming Bible conferences in your area, or details of our missionary outreach, call 800-977-2177 24 hours a day, or find us on the web at www.compass.org.